Hey, welcome back to another episode of Gear Talk, where we are connecting reliability professionals with reliable information. Pretty excited about today. We're going to be interviewing Lake Speed Jr. You may know him from, you know, different racing circuits. He's got a bit of a history. And what I really like about it is if you get to see on his LinkedIn pages or anything else, you know, he says that he's a tribologist. He has a CLS and an OMA from STLE. So he understands what's going on here. And we're going to pick his brain a little bit on how he may use some of that background and what does a tribologist actually do, you know, in racing. So, Lake, I definitely appreciate you joining us here.
Well, thanks, Wes. You know, I really love that little tagline, you know, or, you know, connecting reliability professionals with reliable information. I like that. That's nice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of our core things here at the podcast is we want to make sure that people understand the individuals, right? Because we all have different information that we want to give out. And we do want to make sure that people understand that it's coming from a place where, in some cases, could be trial and error. We've learned things, you know, what we've actually applied. And you've got a tremendous background. So why don't you give yourself a little introduction, kind of a little history of what you've done?
Sure, because my connection with what the tagline is that what we see a lot in the racing industry is that there's what I call C minus information that gets repeated around as gospel because it does work.
Okay.
Right? You know, the old C's get degrees, but man, if you're having brain surgery, right, you don't want the guy that finished last in medical school. You want the guy that was summa cum laude, right?
That's right.
So what we found from, you know, my experience at NASCAR, to answer that question, is, so yeah, not only was my dad a NASCAR driver and raced for 20 years, I was very fortunate to work at Joe Gibbs Racing, which is one of the top NASCAR teams,
yeah,
for 13 years. And the majority of that time, really about at least half of that time, we were actually partners with Lubrizol. So most people watching this would probably be familiar with, they know who Lubrizol is. So
that's right. Yep.
That's where my connection to the lubricant industry was. Because if you go back 22 years ago, we would have been at Daytona right about now, you know, getting ready to go qualify and do all that for Daytona 500. If you'd asked me then, you're going to be in the lube industry, I'd have rolled in the floor laughing like, what the hell are you talking about? Right. But the thing is, if you had asked me some questions about oil, I would have thought I would have known some things, because we would have been like, oh yeah, we got a chassis dyno. You know, we've been testing oils and we've got all the stuff figured out. Man, I look back at some of the stuff we did, Wes. Oh man, I'm glad there wasn't video back then to record, because we were so lost. We didn't know how to test. We didn't know how to do anything. But fortunately, because of the relationship we had with Lubrizol, we were able to learn the right ways to test, the right way to go about doing things. And it was fun because working with those guys, and there was a really great team of people there, because obviously it's the name, you know, the company Lubrizol, but sure, specifically, there's a handful of people that made that thing go. A guy named Michael Musha, who's now retired from Lubrizol, Doug Jane, who's also retired, Bill Abraham, I think still works there, Sarah Kipp, Tim Thomas, Claudette Cook-Lucas, Jim Dolio, Nathan Valentine. There's a really great group of people there that worked in
kind of really knew the ins and outs of the application. And I can relate. You know, I grew up in construction and farming, and your C minus information being gospel. I mean, when it came to lubricants, we had oil and we had grease, and that was about it. Right? That's about as far
the
as
red
it went.
Stuff's good.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's red means that it's going to stay put, or it's high temperature, so that means it's real good. Right. So kind of walk me through this. So kind of like you're starting out, you think you know some stuff. Like where did you get like aha moments of like, okay, this actually has, you know, a big impact on race day. And I mean, you're trying to squeak every little last bit of performance out of those engines. So, I mean, yes, the oil has a part to do with that, but there's all sorts of other tribological features, right? I mean, between machine parts rubbing and everything inside the engine. So, you know, what's kind of your journey through this?
So I'll give you the overview, kind of the, where we ended. We'll do like a movie, okay, right? Where you kind of show you the end first, and then we'll work backwards.
Okay.
So the tail of the tape with Joe Gibbs Racing working with Lubrizol, basically taking Tribology and applying it to a race car, you know, engines, transmissions, gears, the whole vehicle. In the 8 years that Joe Gibbs Racing existed before, you know, partnering with Lubrizol and applying Tribology to the race car, they had won a total of about 16 races and zero championships.
Okay.
In the 8 years following, when they began this adventure, we won 84 races and 5 championships.
So pretty significant. I mean, at that point, I mean,
even your best statistics folks will know that's not an anomaly, right?
You're
that
right.
was a tipping right. point. Now, there were some things that happened during that time in terms of the growth of the team, everything else. But what we saw was that, and the quick backstory was, so from 96 through 99, we were, Joe Gibbs Racing had Shell as an associate sponsor. Like if you go look back at the old 18 Interstate Batteries car, we had the Shell, you know, Fire and Ice logos on the car. Well, so Shell back then gave us what they called their motorsports blend oil.
It okay. just
came out of Houston and had drums, and that was what we just used it, right? It was oil. And back to grease and oil, right? We were like, yeah, we got oil and it's fine. We don't have any problems.
And I think, you know, what some people may not realize is when you think about like a racing oil, it's not like an API certification or anything else, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's a high performance lubricant, but it's not something that you'd put in a passenger car by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. But we had no idea about that. We were totally ignorant, right? All we knew was that, you know, back in the day, you could go to, I remember this myself, going to the Kmart in Port Orange, Florida, and going and buying every quart of Mobil 1 they had on the shelf, 5W30, and pouring it in the race car and going and running a Daytona 500. I grew
really?
Up. Oh, there
okay.
There was a time before the ZDP reductions and stuff in
right.
and the API specs when that's what you did. You could literally go to the parts store, buy oil off the shelf, put it in the race car, and go run a NASCAR race, and it was fine. That
yeah.
was okay up until the late 90s when we got around the API SL. That's right around okay. the time when stuff started to kind of like get iffy. But we didn't know that at Gibbs because we were getting this Shell oil that mm-hmm. they gave us, and we used it and we're fine. Well, then all of a sudden, you know, I think crude was trading around $12 a barrel back in 99, somewhere around that point in time. And they're like, we're out. We're done with NASCAR. I'm like, okay. Well, unfortunately, we were kind of counting on them to be the primary sponsor for Tony Stewart the following year.
Okay.
And that didn't happen. Fortunately, Bob Nardelli was the CEO of Home Depot. They step in and they're the sponsor. Oh, saves the day. That's great. Unfortunately, you know, Home Depot didn't sell oil. At least they didn't sell oil back then. Right. And they definitely didn't sell motorsports blend oil.
Right.
So in the 99 season, we're out there running and we actually finished second in the championship, but we lost 3 engines during the year, all
okay.
due to flat tappet camshaft failures.
So we would think lack of ZDDP in the oil or something
right.
of that nature. We're reducing characteristics of the oil.
Right. But at the time where we were with our education knowledge, we had no idea that zinc dioxide even existed. We didn't know mm-hmm. anything about this kind of stuff. Fortunately, we were a GM team and they had what's called key partners. So essentially all the teams that GM supported financially, they
okay.
made them get together once a month and talk.
Okay.
Now, you weren't required to share, we call it speed secrets. Like if you found something that made your car faster, you did not have to share that. But the old adage,
competitive advantage.
The old adage we probably all heard a million times is to finish first, first you must finish.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing with GM Key Partners was anything reliability wise, anything that we could do to help make sure all the cars were able to finish the race and get durability, you were required to help somebody else out if you had a durability solution and somebody else encountered that same problem.
Oh, and I like that. So this is a community of best practice at this point. We want all the GM cars crossing the finish line.
Right. That's why GM has won the Manufacturers Championship more than all the other ones have, is because they were really smart about that a long time ago.
Yeah. But
beside the point, what happened was at one of those key partner meetings, the guys from Richard Childress Racing had said, oh, you got to call Lubrizol. We've already had the same problem. Because they had a deal with 76, you know, the old Unical 76. And the additive package had changed. It had caused the same kind of problems. But the guys at 76 said, well, that's an additive package problem. We don't make the additive package. Our Lubrizol supply partner, Lubrizol, does. We got to get them involved. I mean, there's actually an SAE paper you can go look up that's from Tim Wu's Chris Wilson, I believe it was, and a bunch of guys from Richard Childress Racing and Lubrizol in 76 published about, you know, testing oils for NASCAR applications. So anyway, they helped us get the problem solved. And that's where it was the turning point, is that we had this problem. We were failing camshafts in 1999. It cost us the championship. In 2000, working with the guys at Lubrizol, we ran the entire season without a single engine failure, won the championship. And we were like, ooh, this is cool.
We're on to something. Yeah.
And then it became a series of, okay, well, one little win leads to the next win. Because then it was all about durability. Then the next thing was, well, can we find power? Well, if we find power in the engine, well, can we do it in the transmission? Can we do it in the rear end? Can we do it in the power steering system? Can we do it on the axle? So we ended up developing stuff for all the whole car. And that's what, along the way, just kept on getting better and better.
When you say developing stuff, are we talking like basically custom blends for all the particular components, or?
Oh yeah, so that was one neat thing. Right? Yeah. So people that in this group is cool, because like people who watch this kind of stuff, they kind of know. So
right,
nothing we made for our race cars utilized an additive package.
Straight oil.
Everything was a component blend. We had 14 different components in our engine oil. We had gear oils with seven components, seven in a gear oil.
We're getting deep into the chemistry at this point to make sure that the blend recipe is right. And in some cases, right, I've gone to many different blend plants, you know, actually making sure that the blend is done in the proper way can, you know, impact it as well. So I see you pointing at me, I guess.
Absolutely. Blend order. I mean, some of those things were all about, okay, we've got this component in the oil because it's going to do this job, but it doesn't really want to stay in the oil. So
that's right.
We got to put these other things in there to keep this thing still in the oil, and they got to be spaced out certain in the blend order and the temperatures.
You got to heat it to this point or whatever it is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not just throw a whole bunch of stuff in there and spin it up and send it out. You know,
we got a boat paddle in the bathtub, just kind of mixing it together.
Oh yeah. So it was intense the way we had to do it. But it paid off. Right. So, cause a lot of it was,
so you're finding the hidden power, basically you're parasitic loss because of drag or whatever it is inside these different components. And I guess that adds up, you know, cumulatively to where now you're first on race day at that point, right?
Right. So my favorite example of the things we did, and actually the picture's up on my, in my office here still. So it's one of my proudest moments as a tribologist, right? Because once, you know, I didn't have any background. I just was a guy on the race team. And we started this thing, and they're like, hey, can you handle some of this stuff? I'm like, sure, you know, I get it. But then when I saw these wins and then started talking to the guys like Bill and Doug and Mike at Lubrizol, and they started, you know, showing us the way it really is, it was like, ooh, this is fascinating. This is like really, really interesting. And that intersection of chemistry and physics.
Yeah.
Was, ooh, this is neat. And at the time was, I consider it kind of the halcyon days in NASCAR. We had so much money. You know, I always said Home Depot, FedEx, M&M's, Interstate Batteries never cared how much money we spent on oil.
Right.
All they cared about was winning races and winning championships.
Yeah, if the results are there, do what you need to do.
Right. So when they got into doing the two-car draft in like mid-2000s, maybe late 2000s, what we found was that because of the aerodynamic advantage, the longer you could stay in tandem where that one car is pushing the other, each lap you went faster and faster and faster. So there was this cumulative gain in speed if you could stay tucked in tandem. But you could only stay in tandem for so long before the car in the back overheated. And then once
because
you
of
had
airflow.
Once you did the swap, you lost all your momentum. And then you would be back and you'd regain. Of course, every time you did the swap, you also became prone to being attacked by somebody else that was had the run on you. So we were trying to delay it. So when they first started doing it, those guys could run that way for about a lap. Maybe a lap and a half. That's all they could do. Then the back car would be overheating and you had to switch. Right. And that was the situation. Okay. Well, we're like, okay, we got to figure out how to stay in tandem longer. And of course, the entire engineering team at Joe Gibbs Racing tackled it. You know, we looked at everything, radiators, different, you know, what the heat rejection rate is on different materials. What can we do to get the heat out of the engine so we don't overheat the cooling system? But one of the things that we started looking at was, okay, well, when you're pushing, your oil temperature goes way up. Well, now your oil gets really thin. And we're
That's
like,
right.
Well, but the downside is if we put your initial response is, well, we need to go higher in viscosity and oil.
Yeah, that a thicker oil to counteract the heat.
But the problem with that is, you know, viscosity is a fancy word for resistance to flow. And the higher the viscosity you put in the pump, the hotter it gets.
That's right.
So,
yeah, I mean, it's now working harder to move it. Yeah.
Right. So we're like, what we need is something that's got a really high viscosity index. So what we went to the STLE meeting, right? So we're trying to find what's that leading edge? What's that academic research type stuff? And Ken Hope from Chevron Phillips was there. I think it must have been 2010. And he was talking about the metallocene PAOs. And we're like, ooh, this sounds interesting. And so I remember I went up to him after the talk and I was like, this sounds like pretty interesting technology. We had used some of the PAO 2.5 already in some qualifying oils. And I was like, you know, you've got all this data. Do you actually happen to have any of this oil? He said, yeah, we made a pilot batch. We can, you know, we can send you some samples. I'm like, yeah, it's great. You know, send us, you know, 5 gallons or 10 gallons. So they sent it to us. We got with the guys at Lubrizol. Let's say, this is an idea. We put it together. We put it in the dyno. We ran in the engine. We're like, ooh.
Liking the results coming from it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it made more power, but most importantly, it ran cooler. We're like, okay, so we can run cooler with this stuff. All right. This is really good.
So translating more laps in tandem at this point?
Yep, that was the idea. So we put all this stuff together. We go down to Daytona, and I never forget, we went out there, and back then the shootout was actually the weekend before at Daytona. And you'd always have two cars. You'd have one car for the 500, then you also have your shootout car. So we were going to test out all this stuff in the shootout. We went out there in the first shootout practice, and Kyle Busch and Joey Logano got hooked together, and they ran 6 laps straight in tandem and ended up, I think they ran 208 miles an hour. And then NASCAR changed the rules at the end of that practice.
Now, the rule change is related to, I guess, an unfair advantage is what they're thinking?
And no one else could run like more than 3. We ran 6. And they're like, oh, yeah. this is nope. So fortunately, they didn't know what we were doing with the engine. They just said, okay, these ducks that we allowed you, we're just going to make them smaller. So everyone is penalized. And you know, we still had some advantage. We still end up, we won the shootout race and everything. That was the first win. But I remember my little funny story is I remember when we decided we were going to do this, after we dynoed it, we're like, this stuff's really good. And we had to call up, you know, Ken and the guys at Chevron Phillips, and we're like, hey, this stuff worked out really good. We need some more to go to Daytona. Is how much do you have? We're like really worried they're not going to be enough. Like, oh, it was a small, we may only made a small pilot batch. It's only 5,000 gallons. We're like, oh, that's plenty.
We'll take it.
We'll take it. You know, so we were actually the very first customer for Chevron Phillips to buy any of the metallocene PAO. They had to figure out how to sell it to us because they weren't even ready for it to be commercialized yet because it was still a pilot batch.
So in a span of a decade plus some change, you went from, all right, we are buying off-the-shelf motor oil, to now you are a testbed for new lubricant technology and winning races with it.
In less than a decade. It was amazing. It was really cool. The learning curve was exponential. I was fortunate that, you know, obviously you guys do a lot of training and that's
yep.
wonderful, right? And it's great. It's a resource that people can tap into. I was lucky enough that because of our relationship with Lubrizol, even though I wasn't a Lubrizol employee, I was able to go through their internal training program.
Yeah.
So that was.
So neat. You were able to, and of course, now you're much deeper in the weeds of, all right, what are the actual chemical interactions that are going on? Why can't we just throw, if this is so good, why can't we just make the oil completely out of this or something like that? I mean, you have to understand it is a balancing act. So your C-minus advice, you know, as, you know, A-plus advice. So it sounds like, you know, from your side, you were like, well, everyone ran this oil doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best way to go. And actually you start to chip away at that, you know, preconceived concept. And obviously the proof is in the pudding at that point. And I'm sure there's more to it than, you know, just the oil. I mean, you've got to look because I know that you do a lot of different component analysis as well, right?
Yeah. So back to what's on my shirt, right? So I work at Total Seal, and you're like, what does that have to do with oil? Right. But the interesting thing is, so back in that time at Joe Gibbs Racing, one of the ways you're able to take some friction out of the engine isn't just the oil. And we thought about things beyond the oil itself in isolation. We began to look at the entire system. So what's the metallurgy of the parts? What's the coatings on the parts? And can we optimize the lubricant for the coating, for the surface finish? So those are the three levers we really found that can make a difference in the efficiency of the engine, isn't? Because the lubricant itself is obviously an important part. The surface finish itself is an important part. You know, the coating, the metallurgy is an important part. But there is synergy when you get the three of them working together.
Right.
So when I was at Gibbs, Total Seal was one of our suppliers, and we helped work with them to develop from going from the old school, you know, ductile moly, you know, type rings, real basic stuff that's still out widely available today, to going to, at first, stainless steel. And then we moved from stainless steel to tool steel.
Sure.
And we went from, you know, we call it, you know, moly rings to rings that had, you know, CRN or titanium nitride coating. And then in the last, you know, couple of years, we've been doing a lot of work with Dr. Peter Lee and his group down at Southwest Research. And we've actually developed some variable hardness coatings where that outer layer of the coating is softer than the inner layer of the coating. So that basically it runs in like a soft coating, but then has the durability like a hard coating. So it's the best of both worlds. And again, there's synergy in what surface finish you need for that, which is the harder the coating is, typically the rougher it needs to be to get it to bed in. But then you really don't want that because that generates a lot of wear debris. But then if you have a soft one, you can get away with a flat one, but then that soft one doesn't last very long. There's all these compromises. So that's been the fun part of making that transition, you know, from being at Gibbs, being, we'll call it, on the chemistry side with the oil, and then kind of jumping the river a little bit and being on the other side at Total Seal, working on the tribology, looking at materials, coatings, and surface finish, gives you that whole view of, okay, how do we make this system more optimized? And the reality is, when you do it right, just like we went from, you know, 16 wins and no championships to 84 wins and five championships, we can see that same kind of thing in just the efficiency of any engine or a compressor or whatever it is.
If sure.
it's got a piston and a ring in it, we can generally make significant gains in efficiency and longevity. It's not a you have your cake or eat it too. It's like, no, you can do both if you do it right. And that's been a lot of fun to be able to work with different customers and different applications and being able to give them those wins like we did at Gibbs. That's the fun part.
And I can't help but imagine that, you know, everything that you're doing, while it may be, like you said, a piston and a cylinder, I mean, it's got applications that, I mean, people are going to learn from this as well. It's going to help, you know, elevate a lot of the industry. And I hate that we're running low on time here, but I want to give you the last word. I find the story absolutely fascinating. But if you're going to, you know, leave us with any parting shots here, you know, sage wisdom, I mean, what do you have for us there, Lake?
Well, yes, I saw the quote the other day, but different people say it different ways. I think the Lord Kelvin quote was, you know, if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. And then, you know, my other good buddy is Ben Strader, who I do a lot of work with. His whole thing is, you know, if you want to manage something, you got to be able to measure it first, right?
Yeah.
So back to one of the reasons why I'm a big believer in oil analysis and metrology is that you have to be able to measure what we're doing. We need engine dynos, so we can measure the performance of the engine. We need profilometers, so we can measure surface texture. Because I will say, if I want to leave you one nugget, that's the one thing that I've learned in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that was, I'm going to call it the missing link. Because, you know, as, you know, tribologists, people that work in the field of lubrication, especially reliability people, mm-hmm. you're going to have situations where all the evidence, all the parts that you have don't add up to the result.
Yep.
You're like, well, I've got oil analysis says this, and I've got this. But I've got this failed part, and none of the suspects are lining up. Surface finish. Because your eye can't really see what's happening on that surface. It can't really see sometimes waviness that was imparted in a polishing process. You know, I've been into a plant before, and these guys have this part that they're making, and they're making it for an OEM. And on paper, this is the perfect part. It's the best part they've ever designed and engineered, but they put it in the engine to go run the durability test, which is a 100-hour test, and it can barely live an hour or two, and then it's failing. And they're thinking about coatings and heat treat and all this, and we look at it and we're like, what's your surface finish? You know, they kind of
bow their chest up
and they're like, well, it's just an RA of, you know, 1.9. And I'm like, it's too smooth. They're like, what? I said, no, you've messed the part up. It's not able to retain enough oil. It's RA isn't telling you what you need to know. You got to look beyond RA. You know, it needs to be flat on top. Yes. But you have to have some valleys to hold oil. And they changed one thing. They just changed their polishing process. They just changed the procedure in terms of how much stock removal with each grit abrasive. And they swapped it around to make it flat on top and leave a little bit of valley underneath. And it instantly went over 200 hours without any problem. Nothing else.
Small change.
And you put the two parts side by side, Wes. You would never be able to see it. You couldn't measure it with a normal tool. If you did not have a profilometer to measure that surface, you would have never known the difference. So to me, it's the missing link. So really the key message is you have to measure what you're trying to manage. And obviously the tools we were used to having, you know, used oil analysis, things like that, they're awesome. But that surface finish is a key thing to look at because we see it all the time. We've seen diesel engines that are failing and they're blaming piston rings. And we're like, well, let's go look at your surface. Well, that 325 grit diamond you're honing with isn't leaving enough valley for the amount of fuel you're putting in based on your application. And all they do is they just change the grit they use when they're honing and they add more valley. And all of a sudden these rings, this engine that goes from failing in a few hours now just runs and runs and runs and runs and keeps going. You know, even in a race application, we had one customer that had these like crazy, you know, 3,000 horsepower Cummins, you know, diesel drag race and stuff. They were the same engine. They couldn't get it off the dyno. They would literally blow the engine up, scuff a piston every time they tried to dyno the engine. And they changed everything they could about the pistons and the rings and all this. And eventually we're like, there, let's go back to your baseline, to where you started with the piston and the ring. Just change the home. I started adding some valley, and all of a sudden they could get it off the dyno, but they maybe couldn't run a whole weekend. They ended up, when we were all said and done, working on surface finish alone, they could run the entire season, like 10 full events on the same piston.
On the same engine.
Yeah. No other changes other than surface finish.
Yeah. I think it's important. I mean, we live in a world where we're measuring things in microns. Smallest you can see with the naked eye is 40 microns, which is absolutely huge compared right. to what we're worried about. Like, yeah, I very much...
Those are like planets.
That's it. Well, I definitely appreciate the time today. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on Gear Talk. As always, please like and subscribe. It really helps us out. And if you have any other thoughts on topics that you'd like to hear or comments related to this, you can always send us a message at podcast@noria.com. Lake, definitely appreciate it. And hopefully you'll come back. For everyone else, we'll catch you on the next episode of Gear Talk.